A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been taking photos of the skyscrapers going up around Jerusalem. Got some great shots of construction workers and window cleaners way up there, and it got him thinking. Are those people just born without a fear of heights? He recently stood on a 25th floor balcony, felt that woozy, slightly nerve-inducing sensation, and realized he's not phobic, but he's not immune either. And then you've got the YouTubers claiming TV masks without a harness. So the question is, how prevalent is fear of heights in the population? And are some people genuinely just born without it?
It's a fantastic question, and the timing is perfect. Jerusalem's skyline is transforming faster than at any point in its history. You've got the Holy Land Tower complex, 32 stories and multiple 40-plus story projects now approved for the city center. Anyone living here, working here, building here, is going to be spending more time at height whether they plan to or not.
I've noticed it just walking through the neighborhoods. You turn a corner and there's a crane where there used to be a three-story limestone building. It's disorienting in a city that's been mostly horizontal for 3,000 years.
That's exactly the tension. You've got a city going vertical at speed, and a population that includes everyone from the crane operator who eats lunch 300 feet up to the person who can't step onto a second-floor balcony. Daniel's question, are some people just born without it? That's the thing everyone wonders when they look up and see someone walking a steel beam like it's a sidewalk.
The short answer, by the way, is no. Nobody's born without it. But the long answer is where it gets interesting.
Much more interesting. And we should say up front. Daniel's own experience on that 25th floor balcony, that slight woozy feeling, that's not a failure of nerve. That's a correctly functioning piece of ancient neural circuitry doing exactly what it evolved to do. The question isn't why some people feel it. The question is how some people learn to work with it, or, in the case of those YouTubers, get a different kind of reward from it entirely.
Let's start with the basics. What do we actually know about how common fear of heights is? And where does the line between normal caution and phobia fall?
Right, and this is where the numbers help frame the whole thing. Acrophobia, that's the clinical term for a specific phobia of heights, affects about 3-5% of the population to a clinically significant degree. That's the DSM-5 criteria. The fear has to be persistent, excessive, and it has to interfere with daily life. We're talking about people who can't take a job on an upper floor, who avoid bridges, who won't visit friends in high-rise apartments.
3-5%. That's actually higher than I would have guessed. 1 in 20 to 1 in 30 people.
That's just the clinical cutoff. The subclinical picture is much broader. Some surveys suggest up to 30% of people report significant discomfort at heights. That's nearly 1 in 3. They're not phobic, they can function, but they feel it. That knot in the stomach, the slight vertigo, the urge to step back from the railing.
The person on the 25th floor balcony feeling woozy is in the majority, not the minority.
And that's an important reframe. Most people think the question is, am I abnormal for feeling this? When the real baseline is, almost everyone feels this. The abnormality is at the extremes. The person paralyzed by a second floor balcony, and the person scaling a TV mast without a rope.
That spectrum is what Daniel's really asking about. You've got the construction worker operating a crane 30 stories up without a second thought. You've got Daniel feeling woozy but functional. And you've got the person who can't even step onto a balcony. And on the far other end, the urban climbers who seek out the tallest structures they can find.
Three very different relationships with the same underlying system. And to understand the spectrum, we need to go back to some classic experiments that ask, is this fear something we're born with, or something we learn?
This is where you're going to tell me about babies and glass tables, isn't it?
I am absolutely going to tell you about babies and glass tables. The Visual Cliff Experiment, 1960, Eleanor Gibson and Richard Walk. They built a table with a glass top. Underneath the glass, on one half, a checkerboard pattern right up against the surface. On the other half, the same checkerboard pattern, but dropped several feet below the glass, so it looks like a sheer drop-off. The glass is continuous, so there's no actual danger. An infant can crawl right across it safely.
The infant doesn't know that.
The infant doesn't know that, and here's what happens. They put 6-month-old infants on the shallow side, and their mothers stand on the deep side, calling to them, smiling, holding out a toy. The infants crawl to the edge of the visual cliff. They pat the glass. They can feel it solid, and they refuse to cross. Even when the mother is right there, even when they can touch the surface and feel it's hard, they will not crawl over that apparent drop.
They're not learning this from experience. They can't have fallen off enough tables at 6 months old to have developed a conditioned fear.
And it's not just human infants. They tested newborn animals, goats, chicks, lambs, kittens, animals that can walk within hours or days of birth. The newborn goat placed on the shallow side will freeze at the edge of the deep side. It's never fallen off anything in its life. It was born with that avoidance.
Which suggests this is hardwired. Not a learned behavior, but an innate depth perception-based avoidance system.
That's the core finding, and it's held up for over 60 years. We are born with a caution system around heights. It's not taught, it's not modeled, it's not cultural. It's in the architecture of the brain.
And this is the but. I can hear you winding up. Innate avoidance is not the same thing as innate phobia.
That's exactly the distinction. The visual cliff work shows we're born with a height caution system. But phobia, the kind that meets clinical criteria, that impairs function, that requires an additional layer. Often, it's a traumatic or vicarious learning experience. A fall in childhood. Seeing someone else fall. Even parental modeling. A parent who screams and grabs the child every time they approach a railing.
The base wiring is universal, but the volume knob gets turned up by experience.
We know this from twin studies. The heritability of acrophobia, the proportion of the variants explained by genetics, is moderate, around 30 to 40%. That means environment and experience play a larger role than genes. You're not born phobic, you're born with a caution system, and for most people it stays at a functional level. For some, life turns up the volume.
I want to sit with the mechanism for a second, because Daniel mentioned that woozy feeling, and I think most people know exactly what he's talking about. What's actually happening in the brain and body when you look down from a height and feel that lurch?
This is where it gets really interesting. There are two systems colliding. Your visual system is sending one signal, it sees the drop, it detects the distance, it's computing optic flow, which is the pattern of motion across your retina as you move. At a height, the optic flow patterns are different. Things far below you move differently than things close up. Your brain knows this means you are high up.
The other system?
Your vestibular system, the balance organs in your inner ear. They're telling your brain where your head is in space, whether you're upright, whether you're moving. When you're standing on a solid balcony, your vestibular system says, "We're stable, we're level, everything's fine." But your visual system is screaming, "There's a huge drop." The mismatch between those two signals is what produces that woozy, vertiginous sensation. Your brain doesn't know which system to trust, so it generates a kind of sensory conflict alarm.
It's not actually fear, initially. It's a perceptual glitch.
It starts as a perceptual conflict, but the brain doesn't like unresolved conflict, so it escalates. The amygdala, the brain's threat detection hub, gets recruited. And then a structure called the periaqueductal gray, or PAG, deep in the midbrain, activates what researchers call the freeze circuit.
The periaqueductal gray. That's a phrase I'm going to make you say at least twice more.
It's a mouthful, but it's crucial. The PAG is ancient. We share it with reptiles. It's part of the brain's most primitive threat response system. When it fires, it produces freezing, withdrawal, the urge to get low, and retreat from the edge. This is not a conscious thought. It happens before you can even name what you're feeling.
This is a circuit that's going haywire in someone with a phobia?
There was a great fMRI study by Mobbs and colleagues in 2009. They put people in a virtual reality height scenario, standing on a platform that appeared to be high up, and scan their brains. In phobic individuals, the PAG freeze circuit lit up like a fire alarm. In non-phobic controls, there was still some activation. Remember, the system is universal. But the key difference was in the prefrontal cortex.
The thinking part of the brain.
The regulatory part. In non-phobic individuals, the prefrontal cortex was actively dampening the amygdala and PAG response. It was essentially saying, I see the drop, I register the threat, but I also know there's a railing, I know the balcony is structurally sound, I know I'm safe. The phobic brain wasn't doing that regulation effectively. The alarm was ringing and nobody was answering the phone.
It's not that phobic people have a fear system that non-phobic people lack. It's that their regulation system isn't keeping up.
That's the current model. Everyone has the alarm. The difference is in the volume control and the off switch.
Which brings us back to Daniel's construction workers. If everyone has the alarm, how do you eat lunch on a steel beam 300 feet up?
That is exactly where we need to go next. Because the answer is not, they were born without the alarm. The answer is, they've built a relationship with it.
If we're all born with some degree of height avoidance, how do people end up on such different points on the spectrum, from the crane operator to the rooftop climber?
Let's start with the construction workers and window cleaners, because they're the ones Daniel was photographing. And the first thing to understand is that most of them are not fearless. The research on high-altitude workers, and there's a good body of it, consistently shows that they experience fear, especially early in their careers. What they've developed are coping strategies.
What kind of strategies?
Three main ones. Repeated exposure to a stimulus reduces the startle response over time. Your brain learns, I've been up here 100 times and nothing bad happened. The amygdala's threshold for firing creeps upward. Second, attentional focus. Experienced workers learn to concentrate on the task, the weld, the window frame, the cable, rather than the drop. They're not looking down, they're looking at their hands.
It's a kind of selective attention. You narrow your world to the task.
And third, trust in safety equipment. Harnesses, lanyards, guardrails, netting. When you believe the equipment will catch you, the threat appraisal changes. Your prefrontal cortex has better data to work with when it's trying to regulate the amygdala. It can say, yes, there's a drop, but the harness is rated for 5,000 pounds, and it's clipped to a certified anchor point.
There was a study of Israeli construction workers, wasn't there?
Yes, from 2018. They looked at self-reported fear of heights across different experience levels. The finding was clear. Fear decreased with years of experience. The veterans reported much less fear than the newcomers. But here's the twist. Even the veterans reported occasional height nausea on new, unfamiliar structures. And physiological measures, heart rate, cortisol, still showed elevated responses.
The body was still reacting. They just learned to interpret it differently or override it.
Or simply tolerate it. The alarm still rings. They've just stopped being surprised by the ringing.
That's a useful distinction. It's not that the fear goes away. It's that you develop a tolerance for its presence.
This is relevant to the Israeli construction context specifically. Jerusalem's building boom is driven by population growth and government incentives for high-density development. Many of the workers on these sites are Palestinian laborers from the West Bank, or foreign workers from China and Eastern Europe. There are cultural dimensions here too. Some studies suggest collectivist cultures may lead to underreporting of fear due to stigma. You don't want to be the guy who admits he's scared, but the physiological measures tell a more universal story. The heart rate goes up regardless of what the mouth says.
The workers aren't a different species. They're people who've built a working relationship with a fear system that's doing its job.
And then you go to the other extreme. The urban climbers. The YouTubers scaling TV masts and cranes without safety gear. And you're looking at a completely different psychological profile. This is not habituation. This is sensation seeking.
Sensation seeking as a personality trait.
Sensation seeking is a well-studied personality dimension. People high in this trait have low baseline arousal, their nervous system is understimulated at rest, and they get a large dopamine response to novel, intense, or risky experiences. For them, the physiological arousal that comes from being at a dangerous height, the racing heart, the adrenaline, gets interpreted not as fear, but as excitement.
Same physical signal, different cognitive label.
The arousal is ambiguous. Your brain has to interpret it, and the interpretation depends on context, personality, and learning history. The sensation seeker's brain says, this is thrilling. The phobic brain says, this is terrifying. Same heart rate, same cortisol spike, completely different subjective experience.
There's also the social reward piece, especially for the YouTubers. The views, the likes, the notoriety.
And that's a powerful reinforcer. The dopamine hit doesn't just come from the climb, it comes from the million views, the comments, the reputation. the risk-reward calculus shifts. The potential social reward outweighs the fear signal, and some studies suggest these individuals may have lower baseline amygdala reactivity to threat cues in general. Their threat detection system might simply be calibrated differently.
To Daniel's question, are some people just born without it? The answer is no, but some people are born with a different set point. Lower baseline threat sensitivity, higher need for stimulation, and a tendency to label arousal as excitement rather than fear.
That's the nuance. Nobody's missing the system entirely, but the dials are set differently, and experience turns them further. The construction worker turns down the fear dial through habituation and skill. The urban climber turns up the excitement dial and learns to ignore the fear channel. The phobic person has a fear dial that's been cranked up by trauma or modeling, and the regulation system can't turn it back down.
Which raises the obvious next question. If the dial can be turned up, can it be turned back down? Can you treat this?
You absolutely can, and the treatment evidence is some of the most robust in all of clinical psychology. The gold standard is exposure therapy, graded, repeated, controlled exposure to heights. You start with something manageable, like standing on a low balcony, and you work your way up. Each exposure teaches the amygdala that the predicted catastrophe didn't happen. The brain updates its threat model.
There's a virtual reality version of this now.
Virtual reality exposure therapy, VRET, is now a standard treatment. The first major randomized trial was Rothbaum and colleagues in 1995, and it showed VRET was as effective as in vivo exposure, actually going to real heights, for reducing acrophobia. Success rates are around 70-80% for clinically significant reduction. People who couldn't step onto a second floor balcony can ride glass elevators and stand at observation decks.
70-80% is remarkable for any psychological treatment.
And it proves something important. The fear circuitry is plastic. It's not fixed. You're not stuck with the volume setting you have. The prefrontal cortex can be trained to regulate the amygdala more effectively. The PAG freeze response can be dampened. The brain rewires.
The good news is that this circuitry is plastic. Here's what the research says about what you can actually do about it.
For someone like Daniel, who's not phobic but feels that slight unease, the takeaway is even simpler. That woozy feeling on the 25th floor balcony is normal and adaptive. It's your vestibular visual system doing its job. It's not a sign of weakness, and it's not something that needs to be fixed. It's a 300-million-year-old safety system that's kept your ancestors from walking off cliffs.
That's almost comforting. Your brain is saying, I care about your survival, please step back from the edge.
That's exactly what it's saying. And if you want to reduce the discomfort, the same principle applies. Graded exposure. Start lower, work your way up, pair it with slow breathing to regulate the autonomic response. There are even VR apps now, like Fear of Heights VR, that provide a safe environment to practice.
For parents, there's a specific insight from the Visual Cliff Research. Infants look to their caregivers' facial expressions when they encounter ambiguous situations. It's called social referencing. If a parent models calm at a height, the child learns calm. If the parent gasps and yanks the child back, the child learns that heights are dangerous.
That's a crucial point. The innate caution system is there, but it's tuned by what the child sees in the faces of the people they trust most.
As cities like Jerusalem keep building upward, the question isn't just about who can handle heights. It's about how we design for the 95% of us who feel that little wobble.
That's a open question. As we get more high-rises, more sky bridges, more vertical farming, more drone delivery infrastructure, more people are going to spend time at height whether they chose to or not. Understanding the psychology of heights isn't just academic. It's urban planning. It's building design. It's about whether we can create spaces that work with our ancient wiring rather than against it.
Can you design a 40th floor balcony that doesn't trigger the vestibular visual conflict? Wider balconies, more visual anchors, textured glass instead of transparent.
There's research on this. Railings with visual texture, graduated opacity, intermediate horizontal elements that break up the vertical drop, all of these can reduce the perceptual conflict. You're giving the brain more cues that say solid surface rather than void.
It's the architectural equivalent of telling your amygdala, it's okay, there's a railing.
And as Jerusalem's skyline transforms, Holy Land Tower, the new city center projects, the cranes that seem to multiply every month, this becomes more than a psychological curiosity. It's a live question for anyone who lives, works, or builds in a vertical city, which, increasingly, is all of us.
Daniel's photographing the people who are already up there, living this question every day. And the answer, it turns out, is not that they're missing something the rest of us have. It's that they've learned to live with something we all share. Let's start with the basics. What do we actually know about how common fear of heights is? And where does the line between normal caution and phobia fall?
Right. And this is where the numbers help frame the whole thing. Acrophobia, that's the clinical term for a specific phobia of heights, affects about 3-5% of the population to a clinically significant degree. That's the DSM-5 criteria. The fear has to be persistent, excessive, and it has to interfere with daily life. We're talking about people who can't take a job on an upper floor, who avoid bridges, who won't visit friends in high-rise apartments.
3-5%? That's actually higher than I would have guessed. 1 in 20 to 1 in 30 people.
That's just the clinical cutoff. The subclinical picture is much broader. Some surveys suggest up to 30% of people report significant discomfort at heights. That's nearly 1 in 3. They're not phobic, they can function, but they feel it. That knot in the stomach, the slight vertigo, the urge to step back from the railing.
The person on the 25th floor balcony feeling woozy is in the majority, not the minority.
And that's an important reframe. Most people think the question is, am I abnormal for feeling this? When the real baseline is, almost everyone feels this. The abnormality is at the extremes. The person paralyzed by a second floor balcony and the person scaling a TV mast without a rope.
That spectrum is what Daniel's really asking about. You've got the construction worker operating a crane 30 stories up without a second thought. You've got Daniel feeling woozy but functional. And you've got the person who can't even step onto a balcony. And on the far other end, the urban climbers who seek out the tallest structures they can find.
Three very different relationships with the same underlying system. And to understand the spectrum, we need to go back to some classic experiments that ask, is this fear something we're born with, or something we learn?
This is where you're going to tell me about babies and glass tables, isn't it?
I'm absolutely going to tell you about babies and glass tables. The Visual Cliff Experiment, 1960, Eleanor Gibson and Richard Walk. They built a table with a glass top. Underneath the glass, on one half, a checkerboard pattern right up against the surface. On the other half, the same checkerboard pattern drops several feet below the glass, so it looks like a sheer drop-off. The glass is continuous. There's no actual danger. An infant can crawl right across it safely.
The infant doesn't know that.
The infant doesn't know that, and here's what happens. They put 6-month-old infants on the shallow side, and their mothers stand on the deep side, calling to them, smiling, holding out a toy. The infants crawl to the edge of the visual cliff, they pat the glass, they can feel it's solid, and they refuse to cross. Even when the mother is right there, even when they can touch the surface and feel it's hard, they will not crawl over that apparent drop.
They're not learning this from experience. They can't have fallen off enough tables at 6 months old to have developed a conditioned fear.
And it's not just human infants. They tested newborn animals. Goats, chicks, lambs, kittens. Animals that can walk within hours or days of birth. The newborn goat placed on the shallow side will freeze at the edge of the deep side. It's never fallen off anything in its life. It was born with that avoidance.
Which suggests this is hardwired. Not a learned behavior, but an innate depth perception-based avoidance system.
That's the core finding, and it's held up for over 60 years. We are born with a caution system around heights. It's not taught. It's not modeled, it's not cultural, it's in the architecture of the brain.
And this is the but, I can hear you winding up. Innate avoidance is not the same thing as innate phobia.
That's exactly the distinction. The visual cliff work shows we're born with a height caution system. But phobia, the kind that meets clinical criteria, that impairs function, that requires an additional layer. Often it's a traumatic or vicarious learning experience. A fall in childhood, seeing someone else fall, even parental modeling, a parent who screams and grabs the child every time they approach a railing.
The base wiring is universal, but the volume knob gets turned up by experience.
We know this from twin studies. the heritability of acrophobia. The proportion of the variance explained by genetics is moderate, around 30 to 40%. That means environment and experience play a larger role than genes. You're not born phobic. You're born with a caution system, and for most people it stays at a functional level. For some, life turns up the volume.
I want to sit with the mechanism for a second, because Daniel mentioned that woozy feeling, and I think most people know exactly what he's talking about. What's actually happening in the brain and body when you look down from a height and feel that lurch?
This is where it gets really interesting. There are two systems colliding. Your visual system is sending one signal, it sees the drop, it detects the distance, it's computing optic flow, which is the pattern of motion across your retina as you move. At a height, the optic flow patterns are different. Things far below you move differently than things close up. Your brain knows this means you are high up.
The other system.
Your vestibular system, the balance organs in your inner ear. They're telling your brain where your head is in space, whether you're upright, whether you're moving. When you're standing on a solid balcony, your vestibular system says, "We're stable, we're level, everything's fine." But your visual system is screaming, "There's a huge drop." The mismatch between those two signals is what produces that woozy, vertiginous sensation. Your brain doesn't know which system to trust, so it generates a kind of sensory conflict alarm.
It's not actually fear initially. It's a perceptual glitch.
It starts as a perceptual conflict. But the brain doesn't like unresolved conflict, so it escalates. The amygdala, the brain's threat detection hub, gets recruited. And then a structure called the periaqueductal gray, or PEG, deep in the midbrain, activates what researchers call the freeze circuit.
The periaqueductal gray. That's a phrase I'm going to make you say at least twice more.
It's a mouthful, but it's crucial. The PEG is ancient. We share it with reptiles. It's part of the brain's most primitive threat response system. When it fires, it produces freezing, withdrawal, the urge to get low, and retreat from the edge. This is not a conscious thought. It happens before you can even name what you're feeling.
This is the circuit that's going haywire in someone with a phobia.
There was a great fMRI study by Mobbs and colleagues in 2009. They put people in a virtual reality height scenario, standing on a platform that appeared to be high up, and scanned their brains. In phobic individuals, the PAG freeze circuit lit up like a fire alarm. In non-phobic controls, there was still some activation. Remember, the system is universal, but the key difference was in the prefrontal cortex.
The thinking part of the brain.
The regulatory part. In non-phobic individuals, the prefrontal cortex was actively dampening the amygdala and PAG response. It was essentially saying, I see the drop, I register the threat, but I also know there's a railing, I know the balcony is structurally sound, I know I'm safe. The phobic brain wasn't doing that regulation effectively. The alarm was ringing and nobody was answering the phone.
It's not that phobic people have a fear system that non-phobic people lack. It's that their regulation system isn't keeping up.
That's the current model. Everyone has the alarm. The difference is in the volume control and the off switch.
Which brings us back to Daniel's construction workers. If everyone has the alarm, how do you eat lunch on a steel beam 300 feet up?
That's exactly where the research on high-altitude workers gets revealing. Most of them are not fearless. They experience the same alarm. What they've built over time is a set of coping strategies that let them function alongside it.
What kind of strategies are we talking about?
Three main ones keep showing up in the literature. First, habituation, the simplest and most powerful. Repeated exposure to the same stimulus day after day raises the amygdala's threshold for firing. Your brain essentially learns that the predicted catastrophe keeps not happening, so it stops sounding the alarm quite so loudly. Second, attentional focus. Experienced workers train themselves to concentrate on the task. The weld, the window frame, the cable connection, not the drop. They're not looking down. They're looking at their hands.
It's a kind of tunnel vision, but productively applied.
And third, trust in safety equipment. When you believe your harness will catch you, the prefrontal cortex has better data to work with when it's trying to regulate the amygdala. It can say, yes, there's a drop, but the lanyard is rated for 5,000 pounds and clipped to a certified anchor. That changes the threat calculus.
There was that study of Israeli construction workers you mentioned.
They tracked self-reported fear across experience levels, and the pattern was clear. Fear dropped with years on the job. Veterans reported far less distress than newcomers. But here's the part that complicates the fearless worker stereotype. Even the veterans reported occasional height nausea on new, unfamiliar structures. And the physiological measures, heart rate, cortisol, still showed elevated responses. The body was reacting. They'd just learned to work through it.
The alarm still rings. They've just stopped being surprised by the ringing.
That's the core insight. It's not absence of fear, it's tolerance of fear's presence. And this matters in the Israeli construction context specifically. Jerusalem's building boom means thousands of workers are up on those sites every day, many of them Palestinian laborers from the West Bank or foreign workers from China and Eastern Europe. There's a cultural dimension here too. Some studies suggest that in more collectivist cultures, workers may underreport fear because of stigma. You don't want to be the guy who admits he's scared on the crew. But the heart rate monitors tell the same story regardless of what the mouth says.
The workers aren't a different species. They're people who've built a working relationship with a fear system that's doing its job.
And then you go to the other extreme, the YouTubers scaling TV masts and cranes without safety gear, and you're looking at a completely different psychological profile. This is not habituation. This is sensation-seeking.
Sensation-seeking as a formal personality trait.
Yes, and it's well studied. People high in this trait have low baseline arousal. Their nervous system is understimulated at rest, and they get a large dopamine response to novel, intense, or risky experiences. For them, the physiological arousal that comes from being at a dangerous height, the racing heart, the adrenaline surge, gets interpreted not as fear but as excitement.
Same physical signal, different cognitive label.
The arousal is ambiguous. Your brain has to interpret it, and the interpretation depends on personality, context, and learning history. The sensation seeker's brain says, this is thrilling. The phobic brain says, this is terrifying. Same heart rate, same cortisol spike, completely different subjective experience.
For the YouTubers, there's the social reward on top of it. The million views, the comments, the notoriety.
Which is a powerful reinforcer. The dopamine hit doesn't just come from the climb, it comes from the audience. The risk-reward calculus shifts. The potential social reward outweighs the fear signal. And some studies suggest these individuals may have lower baseline amygdala reactivity to threat cues in general. Their threat detection system might simply be calibrated differently from the start.
To Daniel's question, are some people just born without it? The answer is no, but some people are born with a different set point. Lower baseline threat sensitivity, higher need for stimulation, a tendency to label arousal as excitement.
That's the nuance. Nobody's missing the system entirely, but the dials are set differently and experience turns them further. The construction worker turns down the fear dial through habituation and skill. The urban climber turns up the excitement dial and learns to ignore the fear channel. The phobic person has a fear dial cranked up by trauma or modeling, and their regulation system can't turn it back down.
Which raises the obvious next question. If the dial can be turned up, can it be turned back down?
You absolutely can, and the treatment evidence is some of the most robust in clinical psychology. The gold standard is exposure therapy, graded, repeated, controlled exposure to heights. You start with something manageable, like standing on a low balcony, and work your way up. Each exposure teaches the amygdala that the predicted catastrophe didn't happen. The brain updates its threat model.
There's a virtual reality version of this now.
Virtual reality exposure therapy, VRET, is standard treatment. The first major randomized trial was Rothbaum and colleagues in 1995, and it showed VRET was as effective as actual in vivo exposure for reducing acrophobia. Success rates sit around 70-80% for clinically significant reduction. People who couldn't step onto a second-floor balcony can ride glass elevators and stand at observation decks after treatment.
70-80% is remarkable for any psychological intervention.
And it proves something fundamental. The fear circuitry is plastic. It's not fixed. You're not stuck with the volume setting you have. The prefrontal cortex can be trained to regulate the amygdala more effectively. The PAG freeze response can be dampened. The brain rewires. Which means the answer to, are some people just born without it, is no. But nobody has to be stuck with the setting they were born with either. For someone like Daniel, who's not phobic but feels that slight unease on the 25th floor balcony, the takeaway is even simpler. That woozy feeling is normal and adaptive. It's your vestibular visual system doing its job. It's not a sign of weakness, and it's not something that needs to be fixed. It's a 300-million-year-old safety system that's kept your ancestors from walking off cliffs.
That's almost comforting. Your brain is saying, I care about your survival. Please step back from the edge.
That's exactly what it's saying. And if you do want to reduce the discomfort, the same principle applies. Graded exposure. Start lower, work your way up, pair it with slow breathing to regulate the autonomic response. There are even VR apps now, like Fear of Heights VR, that let you practice in a safe, controlled environment.
For parents, there's a specific insight from the Visual Cliff Research that's worth underlining. Infants look to their caregivers' facial expressions when they encounter ambiguous situations. It's called social referencing. If a parent models calm at a height, the child learns calm. If the parent gasps and yanks the child back, the child learns that heights are dangerous.
That's a crucial point. The innate caution system is there, but it's tuned by what the child sees in the faces of the people they trust most. You don't need to teach a child to be careful around heights. The wiring's already in place. What you can teach them, unintentionally, is to be terrified.
The practical advice is almost counterintuitive. Don't project. Don't narrate the danger. Just be present and steady.
That's harder than it sounds when your own heart is doing a little flip. But the research is clear. The child is watching your face more than they're watching the drop.
As cities like Jerusalem keep building upward, the question isn't just about who can handle heights. It's about how we design for the 95% of us who feel that little wobble.
That's a open question. As we get more high-rises, more sky bridges, more vertical farming, more drone delivery infrastructure, more people are going to spend time at height, whether they chose to or not. Understanding the psychology of heights isn't just academic. It's urban planning. It's building design. It's about whether we can create spaces that work with our ancient wiring rather than against it.
Can you design a 40th floor balcony that doesn't trigger the vestibular visual conflict? Wider balconies, more visual anchors, textured glass instead of transparent.
There's research on this. Railings with visual texture, graduated opacity, intermediate horizontal elements that break up the vertical drop. All of these can reduce the perceptual conflict. You're giving the brain more cues that say solid surface rather than void.
It's the architectural equivalent of telling your amygdala, it's okay, there's a railing.
And as Jerusalem's skyline transforms, Holy Land Tower, the new city center projects, the cranes that seem to multiply every month, this becomes more than a psychological curiosity. It's a live question for anyone who lives, works, or builds in a vertical city, which, increasingly, is all of us.
Daniel's photographing the people who are already up there, living this question every day. And the answer, it turns out, is not that they're missing something the rest of us have. It's that they've learned to live with something we all share.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1890s, a Russian expedition to the Kamchatka Peninsula recovered a set of birch bark manuscripts from a semi-subterranean Koryak dwelling. Chemical analysis of the bark revealed it had been treated with a mixture of rendered seal fat and volcanic ash, a preservation technique unique to the region that kept the script legible for over a century in frozen soil.
Rendered seal fat and volcanic ash. Of course there are. Send us your weird prompts. Maybe about seal fat preservation techniques. Maybe about skyscrapers. Maybe about whatever's been rattling around your head on a balcony lately. Show at myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.